Hello, hello, and a very warm welcome to the Steps to Investing podcast, bringing you the latest market news, company headlines, and expert interviews to help you invest for a better return. I'm Marcus De Silva. And a very warm welcome to, what are we on, Season 6, Episode 9. I hope you're all well. This week in our big interview, we're going to speak to Interactive Investors' Alice Guy. That's the second largest investing platform in the UK. We've got their pensions expert on the pod, and she's going to try and answer whether or not you should be hanging up your workplace pension in exchange for a private one, like a SIP. In markets, we're going to examine two crises in the US, a banking crisis and a debt ceiling crisis. We're also going to have a look at how China is getting on in its post-pandemic recovery. And in companies, we're going to have a look at mega tech, exploring the results of Apple, Alphabet, Amazon, Microsoft, and Netflix. Of course, as always, please, please, please share the pod and subscribe if you like what you're hearing. Okay, I'm going to start with the banking crisis in America. So one thing that's been slightly putting investors on edge has been a simmering banking crisis in the US, which started with the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank back in March, which we spoke about. They've managed to remain, markets have remained quite calm about this, given we're not that many years from the global financial crisis, which of course was very impactful. And this is because it's been quite, there's been quite specific issues with certain banks, really in the mid-tier of the banking sector in the US. It's not been been to do with widespread issues that have affected the whole sector, you know, a systemic issue, not, you know, like, you know, going back to the global financial crisis, like we had with mortgage-backed securities in 2008. So it's not that. It's been to do with certain issues with certain banks, particularly because of rising interest rates. So one of the big issues really with the mid-tiers is some of them kept their deposits in longer-dated government bonds. Longer-dated bonds in particular are quite sensitive to interest rate rises. Bonds are sensitive to interest rate rises, but the longer the duration of the bond, so the longer dated it is, they go out 20 years, 25 years, 30 years, the more sensitive they are to interest rate rises. So when the Fed started hiking interest rates quite quickly and it caught some people unawares, it meant that the value of those bonds dropped, which meant that these banks suddenly started having these paper losses, which people got to know about and they didn't like. And when you combine that with the fact that some of them also had depositors who weren't insured. So in the US, they have insurance on for deposits on accounts, much like we do in the UK. The government backs them, basically. So in the UK, we have the Financial Services Compensation Scheme, which means that a person at a bank is insured up to £85,000. If something goes wrong with the bank, the government will give you that money back. In the US, it's you're insured up to the tune of $250,000. And there were quite a lot of account holders at certain banks that have much larger deposits than that. And so when it doesn't require a lot of a knock to confidence with people and their money for them to start going, I don't know if I want to have my money here anymore. And what they were doing was taking that money out of the mid tiers and putting it into the much larger banks who were deemed much safer, you know, the JP Morgans of this world. And that had, so basically we saw a bit of a bank run with these mid-tier banks, and that's where a lot of this kind of issue lies. You know, the good thing being that it wasn't, as I said before, to do with terribly bad investments or really toxic assets. It was more to do with some poor risk management, really, of those who hadn't quite thought that interest rates could rise, and therefore should so much of the, you know, so many deposits be really held in long-dated government bonds. So that was really the big thing there. You know, what's the impact been? It's not been too bad. Lending hasn't seized up too much in the US, which is good. We saw some failures. One failure was First Republic Bank in recent times, which has been scooped up by US giant JP Morgan. That has actually calmed nerves in recent weeks. And I suppose what it does is raise some questions, really, over what the regulators deem to be safe assets, because they stress test the banks and they check that they've got plenty of liquidity to protect against exactly these things, bank runs. So I think it's going to bring that into a bit of a focus. And, you know, it might change the way in which regulators do the stress testing. But, you know, it's not been because they've just been really, really silly with their lending. It's really just been to do with this wrong footing because of the surprising speed with which interest rates were hiked. Okay, on to, well, keeping with the US, but on to the debt ceiling crisis. Got another crisis there as well. So in the US, there's a bit of an issue with this ridiculous self-imposed limit that the government has on the amount of money that it can borrow, called the debt ceiling. And the thing is that the US government spends more than it takes in tax revenues. So each year, it has to borrow in order to make up that difference. And the deficit in that is added on to the pile of debt that the country has. So that grows each year. And what Congress have the power to do is to set a limit as to how much that debt can grow. And as it stands at the moment, the current debt limit is $31.4 trillion. So it is an enormous amount of money. I think there's actually a clock that shows the amount of debt just ticking up all the time somewhere. I think somewhere near Wall Street or somewhere in New York. Anyway, so there's this limit. Only Congress can raise this limit, which means whenever we approach this limit, which is, has been many, many times, then there's always a bit of a standoff between the parties as they sort of use the threat of the severe consequences that would, you know, occur in order to extract wins in their own budgetary agendas, depending on, you know, which political side that they're on. What are those consequences? Well, in theory, if no agreement is reached, then the US could default on its debt, which would have enormous financial repercussions. And there would be lots of financial and economic chaos that would spread way beyond its borders. It would be a global issue. So markets, you know, and stock markets would crash. So markets get pretty rattled whenever we approach this. And they started to get a bit more nervous when the Treasury Secretary and former Fed Chair, Janet Yellen, came out said quite recently that the money would run out as soon as June 1st. And that was sooner than the economists had forecast. So suddenly they're like, oh dear, this is going to be an issue sooner. And the problem is, for the moment, even though there's been meetings, lawmakers from across the political divide are not in agreement. So that's not great. And what makes them nervous is that in the past we've seen brinkmanship. So, you know, getting right to that limit as they try to pressure each other to extract concessions. So it's going to be one that's going to hang over until it's resolved. It's going to hang over markets and until this is resolved. So one to watch. Okay, final story in markets. I think just China, actually. I noticed this recently. You know, China, since it restarted, really, its economy after these really draconian COVID restrictions, there was lots of hope around the fact that it would sort of serve as this global post-pandemic economic powerhouse, but those hopes are being slightly dashed recently with April's economic numbers not looking so good and showing that its recovery is faltering a little. In particular, industrial output and retail sales growth undershot what the economists have been expecting by quite a long way, which means that it seems the economy, this big behemoth economy, is not quite as insulated from global woes as you might have thought. And of course, that includes things like the banking crisis, the Ukraine war, rising interest rates, and so forth. It comes as other data as well, such as imports has been quite weak. So that has unnerved investors a little for the moment. China's central bank is doing nothing about interest rates, but markets are betting that there will be some monetary policy easing before the year is up. So yeah, seems restarting this sort of juggernaut is not quite as smooth as you might have expected. If you kind of expected that, I don't think it would have been smooth anyway, but there you go. All in all, over the month, the S&P 500 is up 0.28% to 4,168 points. The FTSE 100 is down 1.98% to 7,742 points. The Stoxx 600 is down 0.46% to 466 points. And China's Shanghai Composite is down 2.16% to 3,297 points. Okay, just before we get on to companies, I thought I'd say we've got some new pages up at stepstoinvesting.com. We've got a new ISA hub, a new SIP hub, and a new general investment account hub. So if you're sort of looking for those accounts and want some direction into different brokers, then and lots of, you know, have lots of questions answered, then there's loads of information in those. Please check them out. We've also got some new content up on the YouTube channel as well, with a new tutorial that talks about the tax tsunami that sort of come our way this year and will continue next year, and some of our key tips for getting around that tax tsunami, how you can sort of invest efficiently. So please check that out. Okay, companies. I thought I'd just end on five of the mega size tech stocks. So, you know, you look at markets up to the end of 2022, and US markets, which are filled with lots of innovative growth companies, had outperformed non-US markets in 8 out of the 10 years, okay? Why were they so dominant in that decade? Because in an era of low interest rates and cheap money, lots of quantitative easing, what investors were opting for were big innovative companies that were going to build, you know, building great businesses, but had a lot of those profits probably booked in the future. You know, they're going to be really profitable, but it's going to be later on. And that's fine because money's pretty cheap. What happened in 2022 is as inflation got out of hand, really, and interest rates started to rise markedly, is investors for the first time in a while switched away from liking those to liking companies that were producing a lot of cash today because there was lots of uncertainty. So I want cash now because I'm uncertain about the future and where's everything going to go. So it meant that unceremoniously, lots of tech stocks were dumped, and it wasn't a great year for tech. It wasn't a great year for growth. It wasn't a great year for US markets in 2022. So quite a lot of interest about, you know, how are the tech companies actually doing in a world of higher inflation. And so I thought I'd report on those. So first of all, Apple. There was not a lot of optimism about Apple going into the results. Investors were fretting over its supply chain issues that it's had and the effect of inflation on the consumer and the fact that it sells quite premium electronics. Well, whilst revenue was lower in its second quarter, fiscal quarter this is, in comparison to last year, it beat what analysts were expecting. And this was largely because of record iPhone sales. Alphabet, that's the owner of Google, for its first quarter, its first fiscal quarter, revenue beat expectations, even as ad revenues were largely down year on year. What was exciting was that their cloud business has finally become profitable, and this has been fueled by an uplift in demand because of the excitement around AI and the fact that obviously that you were going to need lots of computing power for that. So that's been a really good theme in general for some tech stocks. Alphabet was one of them. The other one to note on that is Microsoft, which gets us onto our third one. It saw its third quarter revenues rise with its growth driven by its cloud offering, as they're seen as in a pretty strong position in terms of AI. And what leadership was saying, investors are seeing, is that the reason why they're seen in a strong position is because it's going to be able to integrate AI into lots of its products probably quite easily. That will expand margins as it sort of strives to improve business efficiency. So that was pretty good. What was surprising was Amazon, which has a big cloud business, AWS, Amazon Web Services, it actually saw a slowing in growth in its cloud services. So that was a bit of a surprise. And so the growth in its cloud services slowed from 20% to 16%. And that was because of this cutback by corporate. So that was a surprise, given that those other two had sort of their cloud businesses seemed to be doing quite well. And because of that, Amazon shares fell, even though its overall revenues beat what the analysts were expecting it to deliver. Final one to mention, Netflix. So its revenues rose 8% in the first quarter, which was in line with expectations. It added 1.75 million subscribers, which were actually behind analyst expectations. Business seems in good shape, but investors are not quite convinced yet. They saw that this new lower-priced ad tier service seems to be working in terms of adding subscribers, and it's not cannibalizing too many customers away from its higher-priced tiers. But it's a bit of a wait and see with this one to see how Netflix gets on. So there you go, five little stories in companies there. Right, let's get on to our interview with Alice Guy. Hello all, and welcome to the big interview on the Steps to Investing podcast. I'm Marcus De Silva. So within these interviews, what we do is speak to lots of experts from what I would describe as across the investing journey, in order to really hone in on those topics that we know that you have lots of questions on. Today, we're wandering back into the very popular topic of pensions. Probably the most, retirement is probably the most important financial goal that you will have in your life. And we're going to try and answer this particular question. Should I opt out of my workplace pension and invest in a private pension such as a SIP instead? To help me answer this particular question, I've got the perfect person on the podcast. I'd like to welcome investing platform Interactive Investors, Head of Pensions and Savings, Alice Guy. Alice, welcome.
Hi, Marcus. Lovely to be here.
Lovely to have you. So let's start off with some definitions just to get the thing going a little bit. What is a workplace pension and what is a private pension such as a self-invested personal pension, a SIP?
So your workplace pension, if you're employed, you will have access to a workplace pension and it's set up by your employer. So under auto-enrolment rules, which came in 2012, all employers have to provide employees with a workplace pension now, and the total contributions will be 8% of your salary. There's actually a small amount at the bottom that isn't necessarily contributed to, but generally employers will contribute 3% of your earnings and you contribute 5%. So you're basically getting free money because you're putting in 5% of your income and your employer is topping that up, as well as the government topping it up with pension relief. Now, a SIP or a private pension is one you set up yourself. So they can be really great if you're self-employed. And the other big area where people tend to move across to private pensions or SIPs is when you've been with various employers. We know that a lot of people are with an average of six different employers or even more throughout their life. So you can end up with loads of confusing little pots. And it can be really great to bring those all together into one place, and it's much easier to manage your investments. And there are various other advantages potentially to a private pension, which I think we'll come on to later.
Okay, brilliant. Okay, so, one comes through your employer. The other one is something that you set up and manage yourself. So let's sort of try to unpick kind of figuring out which we should sort of go with. And let's start with the disadvantages of using a SIP versus using, going through your workplace pension.
Well, I think for most people, as I say, if you're employed, the big, big advantage of your workplace pension is that you get those free contributions from your employer. It will be a minimum of 3% of your qualifying earnings. And But a lot of employers actually pay in a little bit more than that. It really depends on your employer. So look at your own scheme and find out what the deal is. But a minimum of 3% of your qualifying earnings, and then you pay in on top of that. So that means that basically, if you're contributing £100 a month to your pension, your employer will be contributing 60 on top of that. And that is basically free money. If you opt out of your workplace pension, legally your employer doesn't have to contribute anymore. So if you say, right, I'm going to opt out and go into a private pension, or just I'm going to opt out because I don't want to save into my pension at the moment, you'll be losing out on that extra employer contribution potentially. There are a few employers that will still contribute, but that's up to them. So just like check with your employer. But in general, I'd say be really careful opting out, because you miss on out on that free money. So that is probably the main disadvantage to a private or a private pension or a SIP. You could be missing out on that free employer money.
Okay, so if you were to opt out of your workplace pension, open up a SIP, you could still benefit from, you know, the other things that pensions give you, like the tax relief, but your employer might not give you that contribution. They might do, though. There are circumstances where they'll say, yeah, we'll contribute into your SIP.
There's nothing to stop them contributing to a SIP. So the way it would work is you'd still have to opt out of your workplace pension. And then your employer could say, well, instead, I'm going to put that contribution into your SIP for you. Most employers don't want to do that, though, because it's extra paperwork for them. But there's nothing theoretically to stop them, but you'll just need to check that out with your employer. It might be that you've got an existing SIP or an existing personal pension, and you prefer to have that to the workplace pension, because with workplace pensions, you don't get a choice in your pension provider.
Okay, I can see that. So if you've got 1,000 employees and they're all wanting to opt out of the workplace one and set up their own SIPs, and you're having to contribute to all those different SIPs, you can see why that could become a massive administrative headache for them, basically.
It can be. I mean, it is just a form or two they have to fill in, but I know in practice a lot of employers prefer to stick with the workplace pension. And also there's an issue for them, because they're legally obliged to auto-enrol you, so they'll have to then recheck, I think it's in 3 years, and say, do you want to opt back in? So there's just a little bit of administration involved.
Okay, so that is the disadvantages. What are the advantages of using a SIP versus a workplace pension?
Well, I'm a massive advocate of SIP. So, and like one of the really big advantages for investors, and this is something that gets people really excited, is the amazing flexibility you get with a SIP. So with a workplace pension, you'll be limited to the range of pension funds that your employer has your employer's scheme has chosen. So relatively small selection of funds. With a SIP, you've got access to the whole market. So you can invest in individual shares. You can invest in funds, but also ETFs, investment trusts. And you've also got access to a much wider range of assets potentially. So you could look at investing in something like commodities or infrastructure funds. So you've got a really wide choice. And particularly as you approach retirement and think about your strategy for investing going into retirement, you may want to tweak that and have a slightly different range of options. So for example, a lot of people moving into retirement like to invest for income, so they might focus on funds where there are funds where they have big dividend payers. Some of the bigger companies traditionally that will sometimes pay 4% on average each year, and you can then sort of take that as income and either reinvest or take that out as income once you start to draw a pension.
Okay, that's really interesting. Because I suppose there are some people who really get into the weeds of investing, really, really enjoy it. And actually, you know, diversified funds is not a lower risk isn't the right word, but it's a more risk managed kind of way of investing in the stock markets, whereas some people really like to take lots of risk, actually go out there, really, you know, select companies, find individual shares, and they quite like the idea of being able to potentially punt for those bigger returns. So I suppose that's some of the advantage of using a SIP, is that you can craft it into any portfolio that you want, rather than being set on these certain paths.
Yeah, you can, and you can tailor it to your own risk appetite and what you want to invest in the same way you would with a general investment account or a stocks and shares ISA. You can also pick, a tracker, something like a Vanguard Life Strategy Fund, if you want something that's a kind of simple solution as well. So you don't have to go for some kind of really complex strategy. It's really up to you. And that's the beauty of it, that you've got that flexibility. The other main advantage I'd say is when you are consolidating, you'll often be able to bring down the cost of your pension overall. And we know that when we look at investment growth, we're really looking for that compounding over time. So small amounts of fee differences can really eat into your investment returns over time. When you think about retirement, say you're 40, you've still got potentially that could be invested for kind of 80 years if you're looking at doing income drawdown in retirement. So, small amounts really do mount up, and looking at those cost advantages can really help. And also, I think the advantage of consolidation is it's just much easier, isn't it, than when you've got different pots. It's really hard to kind of keep track of where you're investing, what your performance is between your different pots, and to really work out some sort of overall strategy. So that does make it loads easier. I think the other thing with SIPs and private pensions is they can be great if you're self-employed, or if a lot of people now, they don't necessarily work for one employer for life. They might do contracting for a while, be self-employed, come back into employment, and you can have that SIP that you kind of keep on the go. And then each time you kind of leave an employer, you can kind of transfer in and keep topping that up and building that up over time. And it really helps you to sort of feel that's really your pension, rather than I've got like lots of random scattered pensions I'm not really sure about.
Just on the, the costs associated with pensions, is this something that you see that workplace pensions can be quite expensive? They can have quite high charges.
I think the cost has really come down over the years, and it is something that the regulator actively keeps an eye on. Some people are in really old pension schemes, though, that do have quite high costs. If you open a scheme now, the fees are capped at 0.75% for a workplace scheme. But older schemes can be a lot higher than that. It really depends, like legacy schemes. Now, 0.75 might not sound a huge amount, but even say you've got a pension that you've built up over time and you've got a pot of 100,000, even a 0.02 difference in fees is going to mount up to hundreds of pounds a year in terms of your fees on your fund once you're getting to a reasonable pot size. So it really does eat in. I wouldn't say they're expensive, but it's one of those things where every little helps and you can just eke out a little bit more.
Okay, so also just moving on a little bit, we have seen this year that there have been some actually big changes to pensions for the first time in a little while. Do you want to explain what these are and whether they actually alter any of that consideration between workplace pension, private pension?
So there are three really big changes this year. The lifetime allowance has been in the headlines massively, hasn't it? And I think in reality, that probably won't affect most of us. So the lifetime allowance previously capped the total amount you could have in your pension at 1.1 million. And if you breached that amount, you would potentially get a tax charge when you crystallised your pension of 55%, which is like really scary, isn't it? So I think it was having a dampening effect, because even if people were thinking, I'm nowhere near 1 million, they were still thinking, well, maybe if my investments do really well, and it was just making them think, oh dear, I might be whacked with a massive tax charge further down the track. So that's completely gone now, which is great. There's also an annual cap on what you can put into your pension. That's been increased from 40,000 to 60,000. So that means that's a cap on the amount you can actually pay in any given tax year. Now, you can't necessarily pay in 60,000. It's limited to your taxable income in that year. So again, it's most people aren't going to be able to put those sort of sums into their pension. But, you know, it is good that there's more flexibility, especially if you're perhaps older and you're thinking, I want to whack loads in my pension and try and make up for lost time because you haven't got as much in as you want to have. The other thing that's changed is something called the money purchase allowance. Now, this hasn't really been in the news that much, but I think in a way, this is the most important one for most people. So we know that people in their 50s are having these kind of varied careers sometimes where they're dipping in and out of the workplace, maybe going part-time for a while. The money purchase allowance means that if you've started to draw an income from your pension, you've got a much lower cap on what you can put in that tax year. So it's actually was the previous rules that they've now changed is that was capped at 4,000. Now that means that people on something like earning something like 50,000 with a workplace pension could actually be breaching if they'd already taken an income because they'd maybe had some time out and then went back into the workplace. They could potentially be breaching that 4,000 reduced allowance, the money purchase allowance. Now, we did a bit of campaigning on that along with some other people in the industry, because if you are in your 50s, you've maybe been made redundant, you've dipped into your pension, you then go back into the workplace and you think, great, I'm going to try and make up for lost time and whack as much as I can in my pension. Maybe you've paid off your mortgage and you think, I'll really focus on that. 4,000 isn't a huge amount to be the limit, and that's been up to 10,000, which is great. So it gives them much more headroom. So hopefully most people don't have to worry about that rule now. So they're the three main tax things. The other thing that's quite sneaky is something called fiscal drag. Now, what that means is that the tax rules around income and national insurance mean that there are different bands. So you get 12,500 tax free. Then between 12,500 and about 50,000, you pay tax at 20%. And then over 50,000, you pay tax at 40%. And then there's an additional rate if you're a really high earner. Those amounts, those thresholds have been frozen and will be frozen for a long time. Now, that means that you are gradually paying more and more tax on your income over time. And even if you're like a lower earner, because people always think, oh, am I going up into the higher tax bracket? But even if you're on a middle income, like say you earn 30,000, more and more of your income is being taxed at 20% over time because of that threshold being frozen. It has a really big impact on the amount of tax people pay, actually, much more than you might think. And that sort of has a knock-on effect on pension saving, because if you think that you're getting pension saving tax-free, then you're getting a bigger boost over time from pension savings. So if you say you're earning 50 now, and over the next 10 years, your pay goes up to 60 with inflation, but you're now paying 40% tax on the extra 10,000, but you don't feel any richer because it's just an inflationary rise. If you can afford to, maybe you've paid off your mortgage, you can afford to pay much more into your pension than you have in the past. It's only going to cost you £6,000 to pay 10,000 into your pension. So it can be a really good way of building your wealth, because you're basically getting free money from the tax man to boost your investment wealth.
Interesting. Okay, I haven't heard that point before. So because we're effectively being dragged into paying higher taxes, conversely, it does give you a bigger boost to your pension because you're getting more relief.
It does. And I love these kind of little tax hacks. If you can afford to pay more, obviously that's a big caveat with the cost of living crisis, but often people enter their 50s and they perhaps are looking back and saying, starting to look towards retirement and thinking, my pension's lagging, I haven't got as much as I wish I did. It can be really great to know that you can get that extra boost. It all helps. And then if you are contributing through a workplace pension, you're getting that employer boost. Going back to what I said before about how much benefit you get, if you pay £100 into your pension and your employer's paying in 60, if you're a higher rate taxpayer, that £100 will only cost you £60. So it's costing you £60 to pay £160 into your pension. Imagine getting that sort of investment return straight away anywhere else. It really is amazing, like the benefit of tax relief into pensions.
And of course, you know, one thing we didn't mention was that it's tax protected as well. So, you know, any investment growth, any gains, any income, none of that will be taxed either. You won't get any CGT, no dividend taxes, nothing like that as well.
Exactly. It's a bit like a stocks and shares ISA. It's protected from dividend tax and from capital gains tax, as you say. The difference being that you are taxed on the way out with pensions, so you will have to pay income tax when you start to draw it. But hopefully, if you think that if you're a higher earner now and you're potentially going to be a basic tax rate payer when you retire, you will be paying a lot less tax when you come to draw it in time, and you get that 25% tax free as well, don't forget. So that's really a really great benefit as well.
That was just one final point on the things that you've sort of been saying. Triggering the money purchase annual allowance will only happen when you move into that taxable part, the 75%. So sorry, just to, I mean, explain. So when you get to 55 at the moment, rising to 57 in 2028, you can take 25% tax-free, and that doesn't trigger the annual money purchase annual allowance, correct?
Correct. It's when you start to take taxable income that it triggers the money purchase allowance. But I think that is one of those sneaky hidden rules that a lot of people don't realise exist. So it is potentially a worry that people could trigger that accidentally.
Right, interesting. So I suppose we need to then sort of go back to then our original question before we get onto our final bit, where we're just going to have a look at a few tips. How would you then answer this question of which, you know, should I be opting out of a work pension and investing in a private pension?
Probably not for most people, because you'll miss out on your employer contributions. If your employer will contributes to your SIP or your private pension, then that's different, because you'll still get those free contributions. But for most people, I'd say stick with your workplace pension and then consider consolidating into a SIP or a private pension. Or if you want to top up, particularly if you're getting older and you're thinking, I want to boost my pension contribution to more than the minimum amount, then consider having a SIP or a private pension on top of your workplace pension. And another thing you can do, I should have mentioned, is you can actually, if you've got a general trading account with a platform, you can actually drip money into a pension. So there's something called, just like you can do with BED and ISA, you can do BED and SIP. So sell your investments and rebuy them within a SIP each tax year, making sure you stay within those pension allowances. And you'll be able to have exactly the same investments, but in that tax wrapper, and with the boost of getting added tax relief as well. So that's something you could potentially look at doing if you've built up an investment portfolio and you're thinking, should I, you know, think about directing some of that into my pension?
And I suppose all that people would need to be aware of in that sort of BED and SIP process is triggering tax liability. So they just need to be aware of that when they sell down those investments in a general account.
Yeah, so just be careful. Obviously, you've got that capital gains tax at annual limit has been reduced now, hasn't it? So just as you would sell it, it's just the same as in terms of the tax manual, it's just the same mechanism of selling shares normally and then rebuying them within a SIP. But the idea is you can sell keeping it below your allowance and drip money in to either an ISA or a SIP each year to try and make the most of your tax advantages.
And of course, as you say, that's been reduced from 12,300 down to 6,000. So you're allowed up to 6,000 of capital gains before you start getting taxed. And probably the best thing is to do it this year, because next year it's going down again to 3,000. Yeah.
Make the use of the little tax benefits that you can. That's right.
Okay, final section. I think that was all really interesting. Final section, what I thought I would do is just slice up the audience a little bit in terms of their ages and get some top pension tips for them, basically. So what would be your top tips for those who are accumulating their pensions in their 20s and 30s?
I'd say get started. Hopefully you will have been auto-enrolled into your workplace pension, and just keep going with that regular investing, because it really does build up over time. The other thing I'd perhaps say is to look under the bonnet and see what you're invested in, because a lot of people will be put automatically into a default fund, and they will often be invested 60% in equities and 40% in bonds. Now that is fine, and that's a valid strategy, but it's quite a cautious strategy. And when you're in your 20s and 30s, you're still a long way off from retirement. If you think about it, you could be not retiring for kind of 40 years plus, and then potentially you're going to be invested throughout retirement as well. So you're really potentially holding back your growth if you're invested as much as 40% in bonds. So you could look at perhaps a different strategy, looking at either moving into an 80-20 split or even a potentially 100% in equities if you feel comfortable with that.
Yeah, I suppose in your 20s and 30s, that is definitely a possibility, isn't it? 100% equities. Okay, top tips for those in their 40s and 50s then.
Okay, well, I'm in my 40s, so I know all about this. And I think there's a big difference between someone that's 40 and someone that's 59 who potentially is coming quite close to retirement. This is the period where you're really starting to look ahead to retirement potentially and thinking about your strategies and perhaps looking at how much you've got and your projections and if you're going to have enough to meet what you want to achieve with your retirement. So depending on your circumstances, I'd say consider investing more than the minimum amount. We know that studies have shown that maybe the minimum amount won't be enough to meet a lot of people's what they want to get out of their retirement. It will be enough for a basic retirement. But if you want those luxuries and extras, then you might want to consider investing extra on top of that 5% that you're auto-enrolled into. The other thing I'd say is think about your investment strategy. So I've said sort of potentially 100%, 80% in equities. Now, 40s and 50s is the period where you're moving closer to retirement, and it's going to be so individual to each person. If you're planning to retire at 60 and take an annuity, then you want to be potentially becoming less risky as you get to that point. But if you're looking for drawdown, then you might have a different strategy where you're more invested in equities to a higher proportion. So I'd say look at your investment strategy and also consider consolidating if you do have different pots that are spread here and there. Bring everything up under one roof, and then you can think, what do I want to be invested in, and what is suitable for me?
Okay, final little group, those who are on the crux of retirement or in retirement, any top tips for them?
Yeah, I'd say, and this would apply to people who are in their late 50s as well. You've got a lot of different decisions to think about moving into retirement. You've basically been accumulating for years, and now you're moving into the stage where you're starting to draw money out of your pension. And we know that decisions you make at this stage can have a big impact on your outcome throughout retirement. So, for example, if you take a big lump sum out of your pension just as the stock market's dipped, then you could be really depleting your retirement fund at that point. So if you're planning on taking a 25% tax-free lump sum, just think about potentially dripping it out gradually, or just making sure that you're aware that of the impact that's going to have on your retirement income. I'd say also think about your strategy. So you might be someone that wants to have that traditional split 60-40 between equities and bonds. That's something people often do if they're doing income drawdown in retirement. Or you might be somebody that wants to invest in income funds. So you can have, there are various investment trusts, for example, that are really popular with people that want to take a dividend income each year and use that and try and keep their capital invested as much as possible and try and use their income for their to draw down on. So, you know, there are lots of different decisions, and I'd say, like, do your research, potentially get investment advice as well, because decisions you make at this stage are going to have a long-term impact, and you don't know if you're going to live until you're 95 and need your retirement income to last you a really long time into the future. So really think carefully, get advice, and then they'll be able to take all your circumstances into account.
Okay, well, on that note, Alice Guy, thanks very much.
Thank you. Thanks.
Well, a very big thank you once again to Alice Guy. It's always great to have interactive investors experts on the pod. Of course, you know, pensions is a massive subject. Retirement is the most important goal you will probably have, financial goal you will probably have. So if you've got any questions, just send them through markets@steps2investing.com. I have, you know, regularly speak to Interactive, so I can get these questions through to them and get those answers if you really need them. Please don't forget to check out the new videos on the YouTube channel. Let me know what you think of those as well. And of course, we've got our new pages, as I mentioned before, at steps2investing.com. Until next time, goodbye.